Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Lucia thought it was a miracle anytime anyone wrote something. You know, that's sort of like how I try to approach every student writing. Before I get into like, hey, you know, this doesn't make any sense, or, you know, you have too many fragments. You know, first I'm like, this is a miracle.
Welcome back to Working. I'm your host, Isaac Butler.
And I'm your other host, June Thomas.
June, I believe this is the first time this year that we have seen each other. It's over Zoom. I'm looking at a blurred out image of, it's a living room, I think. How are you doing so far? How's the year been?
Oh, it's been good. I'm in the kind of final weeks before my first book delivery deadline.
And so dun, dun, dun.
Yes, it's been really cold. And so it's been actually quite good to be in a place where the sensible thing is to stay in and huddle down and just be at your desk. So that's been good. Speaking of cold, dark, but cultured places, how was your trip to London?
It was great. It was warmer in London than it was in New York because there was that like Arctic snap or whatever it's called. And so it was in the 50s in London and it was like 7 in New York, which did not make me afraid for the future of the planet at all.
No, at all.
Few things about London. The sun rises at 8 a.m. and sets at 3 p.m. So the day is very short.
Yes.
People drink too much. And groceries are shockingly cheap. But enough about me. Let's talk about whose voice we heard at the top of the episode.
Well, Isaac, that was Chip Livingstone. And he's a poet, a writer of short fiction, a teacher, and an editor.
Oh, that's fascinating. So why did you want to talk to Mr. Chip Livingstone?
Well, it was something that he edited. He recently compiled a collection of letters that were exchanged between writers Lucia Boleyn and Kenward Elmslie. Now, I'm not going to pretend that I had ever read those writers. In fact, I hadn't even heard of Kenward Elmslie. But over the course of reading this book, I learned that they are interesting and important artists. And that was an opinion that was just cemented in the interview that you're about to hear. And as someone who just really enjoys reading other people's correspondence, I thought it would be interesting to learn more about what that work of compiling a book of letters entailed. So that was why I wanted to talk to him. But over the course of preparing for the interview, I watched several videos of him reading his work, and I learned that he's a really great writer. Chip's mother was Creek, and he writes about native people in a really interesting way. So after speaking with him, I want to spend more time with his writing.
I think we should also say before we get into the episode, because it's discussed very briefly within it, maybe too brief within the episode to explain what is really going on. There's a kind of true crime case surrounding Kenward Elmslie and a mysterious figure named Mr. Oz. Can you just give us the rundown on what the heck that is?
Yeah. So as we'll hear, Kenward Elmslie, who's one of the correspondents featured in Chip's book, he had a lot of family money. His grandfather was Joseph Pulitzer. And he also lived to 93. He only died in June 2022, and he suffered from dementia in his final years. And as is unfortunately all too often the case, some of the people who he had hired to help him took advantage of the relationship and stole from him. One person who is not mentioned in the book because he came into Kenwood's life after the correspondence ended stole a Warhol and a Duchamp and literally millions of dollars. And that guy was prosecuted and incarcerated, and Chip had to testify at his trial. But there were other assistants. Mr. Oz is one of them, who came before that person, who also took advantage of Kenward in less dramatic ways. They didn't take millions. And a couple of such incidents are mentioned in the book. Now, for legal reasons, their names aren't provided, hence Mr. Oz, which is how Lucia and Elmsley referred to him in the letters. It's a brief mention, but it's kind of, I feel like, a portent of something that was unfortunately going to be a big thing in Kenwood's life.
And if you're a Slate Plus subscriber, what's your little bonus today?
Well, Chip knew both Lucia and Kenwood. He lived in Kenwood's house, and he came to know many of his friends, some of whom were really preeminent American poets. And through that relationship, Chip became interested in poetry and became a poet. So I asked him about how that interest developed and what he did to further it.
Well, that sounds really great. And if you're a Slate Plus member, that little extra something something is waiting for you at the end of this episode. So before we get started, I just wanted to say we really love our listeners. We really love hearing from our listeners. We love corresponding with our listeners. We really love knowing what is going on in our listeners' lives. So if you've got a creative problem that you need solving, if you've got a guest that you would like to hear on the show, if you've got your own solution to a creative problem you think our listeners should know about and that we should be discussing on this show, please drop us a line. We'd love to hear from you. It's working@slate.com or 304-933-WORK. You can call and leave a voicemail. And, you know, frankly, I've got some projects I could procrastinate on. So, you know, this is a perfect time for me to delve deep into listener correspondence and voicemails. Please send them along. Now, let's listen in on June's conversation with writer, editor, and teacher Chip Livingston.
Chip Livingston, thank you for joining us on Working. I wanted to talk to you about your work curating and editing Love, Lucia, The Letters of Lucia Berlin and Kenwood Elmsley, which I really enjoyed. Perhaps you could begin by telling us who Lucia and Kenwood were and how you came to edit a book of their correspondence.
Thank you, June. Lucia Berlin was a fiction writer, a short story writer, almost exclusively short stories, although she was working on a memoir at the time of her death. She was not very well known during her lifetime, but when a posthumously collected book of her stories called A Manual for Cleaning Woman was published like 10 or 11 years after she died by FSG, she became an overnight sensation and, you know, a bestseller in the United States and abroad. And, you know, a lot of people were just so curious about who was this writer. She's often called the American Chekhov, or she is referred to in the same veins as Raymond Carver. But, you know, a very important now American writer or U.S. writer who's held up, you know, very highly among letters in the United States. Kenwood Elmsley, on the other hand, had a different kind of career. He was a poet, a librettist, which means he wrote the lyrics for operas. He also wrote the books and lyrics for Broadway musicals. And he had a very eclectic life, a very eclectic group of friends. He was a member of the New York School of Poets. He had a long relationship with the artist, Joe Brainard, who was also a poet. So, you know, Kenwood was known in opera for several of his works with Thomas Pastieri and Ned Roram. He was known on Broadway and off-Broadway for a musical, The Grass Harp, that he wrote based on a novel by Truman Capote. But that's, you know, sort of who they were. And I studied with Lucia Berlin when I was getting my master's in fiction writing at the University of Colorado in Boulder, Colorado. And when I was her student, she gave me a book of Kenwood's poetry. And she said, you know, she thought that I would, you know, resonate with some of the contents and with who he was. And she often showed me his letters and his postcards. She read them to our classes because she just thought so highly of his letters as well as his poetry and his lyrics. So she had given me some of his books when I was her student. And then several years after I had graduated, she called me up and said, "What are you doing for work? And would you consider moving to New York and working as an assistant for my friend Kimward Elmsley?" And I was actually looking for work. And I had recently moved back to the States from the Virgin Islands and was sort of looking, where am I going to go? And I was like, oh, perfect. You know, maybe can right, being assistant, a poet's assistant, afford me to live in New York? And then, you know, Lucia said, well, you know, he's the grandson of Joseph Pulitzer, and I think right. he has plenty of money. And also, I think the job comes with a live-in apartment in his house,
yeah.
which it did, you know. So I went out to New York and met Kenward and got along, you know, great with him immediately and felt comfortable and thought, you know, this is a really good place for me. And before that, you know, I had mostly exclusively written fiction and nonfiction. But then I was suddenly in this world of poets, and a very particular kind of poets. So while I was living in New York with Kenward, I was not only exposed to a lot of poets and his friends, but I also started taking classes in poetry and got a second master's degree from Brooklyn College in poetry. And
oh
that
God,
sort of
Chip,
master's
you're one of those
degree.
People.
Yeah. And in that, also, that master's degree was sort of, you know, it included a lot of the poets from Kenward's circle, and we studied, you know, writing in those kinds of styles.
Something that you said, I'm actually going to jump a long way ahead into a question that I experienced as I was reading the book. Basically, it's about the difference in their finances. As you mentioned, you know, Kenward is well off. He has family money, and it affords him time and space and assistance. Lucia is not. She seems actually to be really struggling sometimes. She's living in a trailer for a chunk of the book. And, you know, I think maybe that led me to really sympathize with Lucia in a way that I didn't with him. You know, he seemed like, oh, he's a dilettante. She is a real writer because she was struggling. Now, there's so much going on there. That's my stuff more than anything else. But I'm curious if you kind of felt a need to kind of protect them both, you know, because you were close to both of them. You had reason to connect with both of them, you know, to protect Kenward from idiots like me who are just like, oh, who is this guy? You know, and she's obviously... Who am I? What, you know, this is all I've read of both of their work. So what's your response to idiots like me who kind of, you know, build up this backstory about these people who I just know them through these letters that I've read?
I definitely, you know, recognize that big difference in their lives and how that big difference in the finances that they had access to affected their work.
Yeah.
Kenward had... never had to worry about money. He didn't have to have a day job to afford his writing at night. Mm-hmm. He could live the life he wanted, but also take very seriously his time to write and his dedication to writing as art. Mm. I mean, the money was there to afford him to live, mm-hmm. but even so, you know, he wasn't like... That was one of my fears when I first went up to meet yeah. him was, you know, I don't know how rich people act. The only, you know, I'm suspicious of them.
Right.
But he was so down to earth. He didn't have that kind of like snobbery towards yeah. people that didn't have money. Whereas Lucia, you know, struggled her whole life. She, yeah. you know, she had times when she had lots of money because of her husband's having lots of money, but she also, you know, struggled with alcoholism most of her life, which caused her to lose jobs when she had them. And she was also, you know, a single mother most of her life as well. And so she, because she was always having job turnover, she never accrued money for retirement
yeah.
or anything like that. She only taught at the University of Colorado for 6 years. You know, and that was sort of like her, you know, most prestigious career,
yeah.
you know, like in terms of a job, at least with writing
yeah.
And associated with writing that she had in her life. And, you know, 6 years of paying into the system in the United yeah. States doesn't get you anything.
No.
And so she writes in the book, you know, she would, you know, write letters to Kenward in the book about hoping to write, between, you know, semester breaks, because I'm also a teacher in a university MFA program, and you know, that's what I look forward to, that little pause between, you know, spring semester and the next fall semester. Yeah. That's when I try to get my writing done.
And she was also sick, right? And she was very ill, and it took all of her energy just to get around.
And
she was,
finances, you know, it took all of her energy to get around. She was dependent on an oxygen tank to breathe. You know, she had scoliosis as a child, which punctured a lung. Mm. She was also living at 9,000 feet above sea level, where it's hard to breathe. And then, of course, she died ultimately of lung cancer. So, you know, breathing was a struggle for her, as was paying those medical bills. And going back to the connection between them of money and around money, you know, Kenward had an organization called Z Press, in which he not only published writers like John Ashbery and Joe Brainard, but also provided financial assistance to poets and artists in trouble or in financial need. And I think it actually began when a poet was in had a medical need. Mm-hmm. And so he, you know, largely funded that from his own money and provided financial assistance to writers who needed it. And Lucia was one of those writers. You know, I think the last 5 or 6 years of her life, she was basically, you know, had access to her health care, had access to the trailer, and then, you know, the apartment she rented in California, thanks to a grant from Z Press through, you know, Kenward Elmslie.
Yeah. So let's get back to the letters. I'm sorry, I couldn't hold back. So one of the reasons that these are great letters to anthologize, I guess, is that they weren't young when they met. They were already, you know, mature people. They had what they described as an instant friendship. But because they had already had long lives, they had a lot of catching up to do. And since they were very seldom actually in the same physical space, they did that by letter, which is great for us because we also get to, you know, learn all that stuff about them. It's a very satisfying correspondence for us to read and to learn about them. I'm curious, though, how it came about. You know, yes, Lucia I had heard of, but I hadn't heard of him. I mean, they're not like hugely famous people. Who is this book for? Is it for kind of people who really enjoy reading people's letters, people who like a particular kind of literature, people who knew them, their circles?
Well, I think that, you know, all of those potential audiences that you mentioned were audiences I considered as a reason to, you know, try to put together this book, to try to sell it, to try to publish it. For me, I think a large impetus for doing it and who I probably was thinking of as I selected letters, because there were, you know, hundreds of letters that we didn't include. You know, the book includes about 40% of the actual letters. But I think I was thinking of writers. You know, I feel like writers, whether you're fiction writers or nonfiction writers or poets or librettists or lyricists, there's so much advice, I think, that can be found specifically about writing, about getting through periods when we're not writing, about, you know, responding to criticism, often very public criticism, but also just the way writers live and the importance that writers or any kind of artists that are true artists and writers give to their art. Mm-hmm. Because they both taught me so much, I saw them, you know, the potential for their teaching in the letters as I read through their letters. You know, I wanted to share it with my writing students. Like, oh yeah, but one time Lucia said, Lucia was feeling the same thing that you're feeling.
Yeah.
They talk about craft. They talk about writer's block. They talk about tricks that they're using to get themselves to write, you know, when they're not writing.
Yeah.
So I really thought and think a large audience for the book is, you know, people who want to be writers and, you know, just want information about what does it mean to be a writer and what kind of life might you have. You might be struggling to pay the bills every month. You know, you might be desperate to find a grant, you know, that was going to allow you to write for 2 weeks. Or, you know, you might have all the money in the world, but still other, you know, hindrances to you getting to the page. Yeah. And how do we overcome that and live a life that's dedicated to art? And, you know, that's what, you know, Lucia used to tell us, you know, about Kenmore's letters was, you know, this is the way an artist sees the world. But the, both of their letters show that, you know, the way that Lucia imagines a story when she sees, you know, a stranger or a strange car that she doesn't recognize, you know, pulling slowly by the front lawn, you know, and she's going to turn that into a story. And, you know, Kenward might witness something and or overhear a dialogue and then turn that into a really sort of abstract or kind of crazy, kooky poem or, you know, song lyric.
Yeah.
We'll be back with more of June's conversation with Chip Livingston after this.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Hey, Slate listeners, Isaac Butler here. Just wanted to say, if you're enjoying this podcast and you haven't subscribed yet, maybe you want to click that little diggly-do that says subscribe, and that way you will never miss an episode. If you are already subscribing, thank you so much. If you wanted to go that little extra mile, why not leave us a good review or 4 stars or 7 meow meow beans or whatever the rating system is in your podcast app of choice. Thank you so much. And hey, if you haven't subscribed to Slate Plus yet, really, honestly, what are you waiting for? Go to slate.com/workingplus. You get ad-free podcasts, bonus segments of shows like this one, whole bonus episodes of great shows like Slow Burn and Big Mood, Little Mood, and you get full access behind the paywall at a website you may have heard of called slate.com. Go to slate.com/workingplus to sign up today. And now, let's continue with June's conversation with Chip Livingston.
I'm curious about the logistics of how you made the selection. So where were the letters? How did you get access to them? How did that kind of, that whole side of it transpire, and where did it happen?
You know, it was a group effort, for sure. I was organizing it and compiling and, you know, putting all the letters into a, you know, Word documents and, you know, then combining them into a larger master file. But the letters themselves were in various places. Some of them were physically in, you know, her son's homes in California. Mm. Some of them that she wrote to Kenward were collected in, you know, Kenward's home in New York. A lot of Kenward's material had been sent to the University of California, San Diego, which has his archives. So many of the letters were there as well, as well as some letters were in Lucia's archives at Harvard. Mm. So the letters were in different places, and it was hard. It was crazy trying to figure out, you know, where they all were. But You know, Kenward, a lot of his letters he had written on the computer. And so we still had access to his computer. And so there, many of his letters to her were saved as Word documents.
Wow.
And the ones from her to him, not at all. We didn't have anything saved. We had, some of them were typed and sent to him, but even the typed ones were, you know, had handwritten annotations. But most of her letters to him were handwritten. And so then her son, Jeff Berlin, was sort of handling the correspondence for the family from her end. And Ron Padgett, the poet and biographer and best friend of Kenward, was sort of handling, and he was in charge of, you know, Kenward Elmsley's estate. And so the executor of the literary estate. So he was handling correspondence that Kenward had. Both Jeff and Ron were, you know, scanning into PDFs, physical copies of the letters, and sending them to me. And then, you know, so many of them didn't have, we had parts of letters, you know, because, you know, the first pages were lost or the date wasn't put on them or the envelope had been lost. But so much of it was actually saved and collected in both of their homes or in their archives. And so the records were there. In fact, at Lucia's memorial service in Boulder, Colorado, I went to that with Kenward. We flew from New York, and Lucia's sons from California had brought a big paper bag full of letters that Kenward had sent to Lucia and brought them to Colorado to return to Kenward in case he wanted to keep them. And also just, you know, working for Kenward while Lucia was still alive, when he would mail her a letter, he would print it out. He would have me photocopy it. He would keep photocopies of the letters he sent to her as well. And then I would go to the post office and mail it for him. As well as, you know, he would, you know, when he got a delightful letter from Lucia, he would read it to me or show it to me at the breakfast table. Similar to how Lucia would show his letters to guests that visited her home, or she would bring them to class and read them to students.
Right, right. And so, obviously, in the book, you see that they, especially, actually, especially Lucia is often saying to Kenward, you know, these should be published. I hope people, I would love for people to see your wonderful writing. So was your sense always that they both were very kind of conscious of that some people, other people would see these at some point and that they were kind of prepared for that? Do you think that even was maybe conscious in their minds as they were writing?
I don't think either of them actually ever thought that the letters would be published. Lucia, you know, she was not that well known. And so she would have never dreamed of having the success that she ultimately has, but also that someone would be interested in her letters.
Yeah.
You know, like she just, that her was the way she communicated.
Yeah. Her letters are so great.
You know, she wrote as she wrote stories, you know, like just so honestly. And so I don't think either of them actually paid attention to like, this letter is so good, it might get published one day.
Right.
However, you know, Kenward did include a letter or a few letters that he wrote to Lucia in a work of art that he put, a review of his songs and show lyrics and poems that was staged in a show called Lingo Land. And he actually showed himself, you know, like at his typewriter on stage writing a letter to Lucia. And so that was, you know, included in a work, but also just sort of like this was a review of his life. You know, she was a good, a big part of his life for that decade that they were such close friends.
I'm curious, obviously, you know, as all good compilations of correspondence do, you know, you offer footnotes to help readers kind of identify, you know, the people who are being referred to. Again, you know, I know that you can't provide context for every piece of, you know, for everything that might come up. But there were some kind of historical events that I sort of sometimes thought, oh, I'm curious why you didn't kind of go into more detail. One of them was around something you were a little bit, I don't want to say coy because that's almost negative. And I think you were actually being very respectful of Kenward, which is about, you know, he was a rich man. He lived to be 93. You know, anybody who read his New York Times obituary would see that he was exploited by some of the people who worked with him when he was in his later years. Sadly, a not altogether rare occurrence. I wondered kind of how you made your decisions, kind of how much to talk about that kind of thing, you know, almost like hard things in life, hard things that might be sort of embarrassing to him. How did you kind of handle dilemmas like that?
Well, it's a really good question, and certainly something that I was aware of and that Lucia was aware of. You know, one of the reasons she wanted me to go work for him was because the two prior assistants had stolen credit cards or, yeah, you know, like been, you know, let go because of, you know, circumstances where they were taking advantage of his money.
Yeah.
And so she was aware of that and knew that, you know, I would be honest and could, you know, not give a shit about money. And didn't expect it, you know, because I was, I was going to be a writer like Lucia, you know. Yeah, I just hoped one day I would have a job teaching to pay the bills.
Yeah.
You know? And so that was certainly something that she was aware of and I was aware of. In terms of the book and editing the book, I really only, I sort of guess was not coy, I don't think, but for legal reasons, you know, like we didn't include the names of some of those assistants. There were, you know, some letters that I, or some parts of letters that I didn't include where, you know, Kim Ward's writing about his relationship or his, you know, friendship with CW, who's the assistant at the beginning of the book. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, I didn't, he didn't turn into a person that was a real big aspect of Kim Ward's life.
Yeah.
I didn't want to give so much emphasis to this person who then wasn't going to be around for the rest of the book.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, the really big exposure of the theft that, you know, made the news, that happened after Lucia had passed away. But there were, you know, like, but we talk about, or we talk about, she talks about in the book, you know, my sort of jealousy or my feelings about someone they called Mr. Oz.
Yeah.
Well, you know, like maybe 2 months after Lucia died, Mr. Oz, I got the phone call from Kenward to change the locks because, you know, Mr. Oz was no longer allowed in the house and he wanted me to, Kenward wanted me to change the locks.
Yeah.
It was an assistant after that, you know, that Mr. Oz actually got to work with me during the same time I was there. He was working at, a new person came on that worked as Kimward's chauffeur initially. And he, you know, stole an Andy Warhol. He stole a Marcel Duchamp. He stole $3.2 million in cash.
Wow.
And I was actually involved in that because I was part of the trial. You know, that went to trial. He was convicted. He went to jail. He was sentenced to 10 years. And so, but that didn't happen during their correspondence.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
so it's about maintaining focus in some ways.
Right. So it wouldn't be, I mean, I, of course, there's more to the story, you know?
Yeah.
But it's not that part of the story. Like if I wanted to tell the story of the assistants taking advantage of Kenward and just, you know, how that might occur in anyone's life, that would be a different book and a book after their correspondence ended.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious, Chip, you know, as you've mentioned, your report, you're a nonfiction writer. It was your commitment to art that allowed you to meet Lucia, to be introduced to Kenward, to get involved in their particular world. And I'm curious how working on the book specifically, more, you know, you've mentioned how being in their circles changed you, but did working on this book have any effect on your writing, do you think?
I don't think it has had an effect on my writing as much as it's had on my teaching.
Oh.
I think that seeing Lucia, you know, and also knowing the other side of the story, you know, like as being her student, like when she writes about students sending her work, I was one of the students who, after I graduated, you know, we all wanted Lucia to read everything we wrote.
Yeah.
Well, she didn't have time to read everything we wrote. And like now as a teacher, I understand, oh, I don't have time to read all these wonderful things my former students are writing.
Yeah.
But also she taught me so much about, you know, honoring the act of creation or the act of the imagination. And I think that comes through so much in their letters. You know, both of them held such high honor to the act of writing.
Yeah.
You know, Lucia thought it was a miracle anytime anyone wrote something, that they took the time to write it.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's sort of like how I try to approach every student writing, you know, before I get into like, hey, you know, this doesn't make any sense, or this ending, you know, isn't satisfying, or, you know, you have too many fragments. You know, first I'm like, this is a miracle.
Yeah.
It's a miracle that you actually wrote something.
Yeah.
And, you know, and honor that act of creation before looking at, you know, how we might make it better or what we don't understand.
And I have to say, too, that one thing that really struck me as I was reading, again, especially Lucia's work, of how much her writing and her, clearly, her inability to be dishonest, not to, you know, she didn't disguise hard things. She didn't take hard things out of her work. And it caused her endless problems. It caught, you know, lost friendships. She would be cut off from people because some of the things in her life were really hard, kind of weird things, but she couldn't not tell the full story. And there's something just so inspiring about that, even just reading these letters. It's kind of weird to say a true artist because it suggests that other people are, you know, false artists, but really there's something so remarkable about her inability to be dishonest about her life.
Yeah, that's true. She's forthcoming. And I just admire that in other teachers as well, and other writers when they're talking about their process. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, like there's just something that is so attractive or I don't know, even obsessing when somebody is just honest and doesn't have that, you know, facade up. Where I think sometimes Kenward had the facade because he was protecting himself or protecting, you know, the fact that he had a lot of money that potentially someone might like him for instead of for his actual lyrics. Whereas I think Lucia is just like, nobody's going to like me anyway, so I'll just tell the truth.
You know, as I read this book, it made me want to have somebody that I had this kind of almost obsessive correspondence with. You know, the cliche at least is that letter writing is dead. When I was young, I wrote a ton of letters. I don't write any anymore. Did it turn you into a letter writer? Were you already a letter writer? Did it make you more of a correspondent?
I was already a letter writer. I did have long, over years and years, decades, friendships that were primarily through the mail when I was younger. Some of that, of course, has changed now, and more of it is, you know, with WhatsApp messages or, you know, long audio messages sent over the phone now. It made me aware of the quality of, like, even just emails between friends, you know, like of taking the time to be thoughtful with each other. Also, Lucia and I wrote letters as well. So I have some of the letters, you know, it's funny too, you know, like when she was writing about Mr. Oz in the book, you know, like to Kenward, like, oh, I, you know, Chip's so silly. I can't imagine what he's thinking or why he would be jealous.
Yeah.
But then she would be writing to me like, you've got to get rid of Mr. Oz. You know, I knew he was trouble.
So
in that way, you know, she wasn't always so, you know, honest with Kenward in terms of, you know, what she thought about some of those assistants. But, you know, there she was certainly writing that to me.
Yeah.
And now, you know, like even in one of my classes that I've been giving over the last couple of years, I used a lot of, you know, like I said, I used excerpts from their letters to show points regarding craft in my classes. Well, my students this year decided, because of the book Love, Lucia, the letters between Lucia Berlin and Kenward Elmslie, that they were going to start writing each other letters. And so they, like, on their own, you know, I didn't have anything to do with it, but I was really sort of happy they had done that. They put all their names in a hat and they paired up two people, you know, randomly. And they've been writing letters to each other now for about 6 months.
Wow, that's amazing. I love that. Chip Livingston, thank you so much for giving us more background on this incredibly interesting book of correspondence between two writers who are, I am now much more appreciative of their work and their thinking and their commitment to art. Thank you for being on Working.
Thank you so much for having me.
Up next, June and I will talk more about what we can learn from the letters of great writers. We'll also discuss overly confessional writing, figuring out your audience, and when to and not to be discreet. Stick around.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. Now, that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
June, I absolutely loved this interview. Before we talk about it, I just have to get a plug in here because a name that came up in the interview is a writer who's very important to me, and that is the poet, artist, writer, man about town, Joe Brainard. Listeners, if you've never read Joe Brainard, actually all of his work is collected in an omnibus edition, or you could just go out and buy his incredible, massively influential work, I Remember Today. So do yourself a favor, pick up some Joe Brainard. All right, now to talk about your interview. Were you familiar with Lucia Berlin before you read this book?
So I knew her name. That is to say, I knew who she was. I bet I could have answered a question about her work at a trivia night, but I had never read her.
And so are you like a general fan of collections of letters? Is that a thing that you read for pleasure?
I absolutely love collections of correspondence.
So is this just because you're like a really nosy person? Is that what it is? Are you?
That's exactly right. You are. There's nothing incorrect. Yes.
No shame. So am I. That's why we're interviewers, right?
That's exactly right. First of all, I think they're really fun to dip into, which, you know, in these days of super short attention spans is something I appreciate. But, you know, there are a few other things. A few weeks ago, you and I did an episode of Working Overtime about failure, if you haven't heard that yet. And I believe in that episode, I mentioned that artists' letters are one of the few places where they talk openly about failures or stumbles. You know, there's a lot of working out of things and, you know, asking for advice and receiving advice. And I find that really appealing. I think Chip is absolutely right that they're a great place to get an unvarnished or at least a less varnished look at, you know, the artist's life. And I usually buy collections that involve writers I'm particularly interested in, but it can be a great place to learn more about people that you kind of think, I don't know if I want to read a big book by that person, but hey, I sure will read their letters because, you know, the editors, or a good editor at least, will do some handholding with, you know, footnotes explaining who and what they're talking about.
It's really fascinating to me that you talked both about the discretion necessary to do this kind of project, some of which is legally mandated, but some of which is just being a decent person. You know, they didn't write these letters necessarily knowing they would be published, whatever.
Yeah.
And contrasting that with the kind of enormous, totalizing, perhaps problematic honesty that Lucia Berlin had, which was very beneficial to her work and very detrimental to her personal relationships. In a way, this collection's existence and your enjoyment and the deep feelings you had about it may actually be a sign that you don't always have to risk all your personal relationships for the sake of great art. What do you think about this kind of balance?
This book really did bring out like some really strong reactions in me. And that was another thing that I was very conflicted about. I admired Lucia for the honestly super ill-advised openness that she apparently was, you know, couldn't not share. You know, I really got the sense reading these letters that she was just always on the point of oversharing and constantly trying to resist that urge. You know, for example, she got some financial support from an organization and she really, really needed the money. But she kept writing to Kenwood basically saying they wouldn't give me the money if they knew I'd done X. And she was always on the point of telling the people about X, you know, that she'd done this shocking thing. And if they knew about this shocking thing, and so she was going to tell them about this shocking thing. And Isaac, they really were very shocking things. So, you know, my psychoanalyzing of this person I never met tells me that she kind of had a self-destructive streak. And by admiring that, I'm maybe encouraging other people to be equally self-destructive, which the rational me doesn't think that way at all. But you could tell from the tone of my voice in the interview that I actually did rather admire the aspect of Lucia Berlin's personality. I'm very, very conflicted. There's no other way for it about that. What do you think?
I mean, I think that's a really productive conflict to sit within, and it's not resolvable. Do you know what I mean? You can't help but admire someone who's totally uncompromising about some value they have, even if that value is terrible for the people around them, until you actually have to deal with someone like that. That's a totally different story. I think one of the reasons why we love fictional protagonists who are like that is they allow us to experience some of that in a very safe way, because no real person is getting hurt, you know?
Yeah.
At the same time, I think there's a whole cottage industry that particularly targets young women writers, you know, in their early to mid 20s to try to get them to write confessional essays that will live on the internet forever. And it's really predatory. I mean, it's almost vampiric, you know. There was a whole series at a website called XO Jane, famously called It Happened to Me, and every time I read one of those, I was like, this is, no one should have allowed you to write this. No one should have published it. The fact that you were encouraged to is kind of evil. I mean, it was really, you know, I just felt like particularly young women can sometimes be told a certain kind of radical self-destructive honesty is the way to get their work out there. And so that's the part of it I don't have conflictive feelings about. I think that's wrong and bad. And the rest of it, though, I'm just like, well, I mean, you know, there's a reason why everyone was so into girls for so long, was because the protagonist was so relentless about, you know, the things she was going after, you know, whatever it is. And those kinds of relentless, uncompromising artists, the Lucia Berlins of the world, the David Wojnarowicz's of the world, you know, there's a reason why we admire them. But I have known some people like that, and it's a difficult thing to be around.
Yeah, I mean, this also just came up in another book that I just read, a really fantastic book called Trailed by Catherine Miles. It's a sort of reinvestigation of a crime, the murder of two women that happened in a national park in Virginia. And it's one of those stories where the writer becomes obsessed. You know, the investigation takes over her life in ways that are clearly not healthy, which she recognizes and acknowledges. And I just think very strongly that should not be a requirement for writing a book. Writing a book or making a podcast, because it definitely happens in podcasts where you basically have to give up your whole life because you're on the phone 24 hours a day with somebody in prison or whatever the thing is. Like, that should not be a requirement for art.
Yeah.
At the same time, I really enjoyed reading this very good writer's account of recognizing what was going on and just really also being very driven by a sense of justice to figuring something out. So, yeah, I agree with you completely about what my former colleague, Laura Bennett, I believe, dubbed the first-person industrial complex. Like, that is not good under any circumstances. But sometimes a little bit of extremism can be very good to read. Ugh.
I love that you asked Chip who the book was for. That is a question that I am often reluctant to ask for some reason, because it feels, I don't know, crass or something. I mean, that's my issue. I'm not saying you were crass, obviously. But, you know, also some artists think about their audience, some artists don't. You know, my last episode was with Ali Slagle, who writes recipes, and she's very, very conscious of who she's writing for. Obviously, when you're editing a collection of someone else's writing, that's something you have to think about. But I'm curious about your work as you hit this big book deadline. You know, everyone who writes a nonfiction proposal has to include in it who they think the audience is for the book. But beyond that paragraph that you had to write, is this something you're thinking about while you write it? And if so, who's your book for?
Well, before I answer that very good question, you mentioned having to explicitly talk about who you think the book's audience will be when you write a proposal. And that's one of the parts of creating a proposal that can seem just super annoying. I think every writer...
Well, yeah. I mean, you want to just write down like, my audience is people who like good books. Thank you very much because I write good books.
Exactly. Or you just want to say, this is not my job. I am not a marketer. Or, you know, just get on your high horse. I certainly had that feeling. But actually, it was really, really useful just to help me get in that frame of mind. Who is this for? Who am I writing for? Like, yeah, you need to know who your audience is to pitch the book appropriately. And so my book, which just as a reminder, tells some of the stories of lesbian history through six archetypal spaces, is for anybody interested in history, specifically cultural history, social history. But I do have a couple of specific groups in mind. I am writing this for the women who did this work, you know, who built the infrastructure that the places I'm writing about represent, who had what are honestly often crummy jobs that pay very little and mean that when you retire, if you can retire, your social security check will be a lot smaller than it would have been if you'd taken a different kind of job. And, you know, those people have not received the credit and attention they deserve. And another group I have in mind are young queer people who, in many ways, I very much sympathize with and agree with on just about everything, but who I think sometimes write off older women and the work that they did in an unfortunate and unfair way. So I also want to set the record straight for those people too.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you have enjoyed what you've just listened to, please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And here, for the final time this week, is your Slate Plus pitch. Slate Plus members get full access behind the paywall on Slate.com. You get bonus segments on episodes like this one, and you get to support everything we do right here on Working. Go to Slate.com/Working Plus to sign up today.
Thank you so much to Chip Livingston and to our amazing producer, Cameron Drews. And please join us next week for Karen Hahn's conversation with chef and doctor Yoon Sung. Until then, get back to work.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.